You're listening to Bigfoot Live, starring Thomas Gardy, the world's most respected authority on the phenomena known as Bigfoot. Sit back and relax as we take you on a journey into the world of the unknown. Believer or skeptic, man or woman, you will be mesmerized by real people telling real descriptions about real encounters. Fasten your seatbelts, America. It's reality radio at its finest, and it starts now.
In 1967, my whole life changed. I saw the Roger Patterson film on the Johnny Carson show. And I gotta tell you, that's the day I thought I was gonna challenge the world and go out and find this thing.
We had found like 12 tracks in the ground. I didn't want to believe it was Bigfoot.
Oh, yeah.
Did you hear that?
He's moving right now. He's moving right now. He's straight out of the tree line. He's moving to the right. See him? He's going to the right. He's going into the trees right now. Come here, look.
I'm Bob Homark, and I'm a reporter with ABC Television and Tyler Longview. It's been my pleasure to be with Tom Scotty and his team tonight, and I have to admit that I was skeptical. When I came out here, I thought we, at this time in our history, had the technology to be able to find one of these things if it existed. But after seeing the footprints and the dig marks in the sand and what I believe to be a very large creature running at a high rate of speed through the woods, I'm convinced them I had to change my opinion on Bigfoot. I turned, I saw this thing standing by my gator.
When I saw the actual footprints, I realized they were something special and probably Sasquatch.
When I landed on the ground, I was kind of thinking, this ain't no human being. It's got to be something else.
www.searchingforbigfoot.com.
Out in the swamps, what you think I've seen? Something strange, you know. Sasquatch sitting on the side with me, and we're talking mocks and joke. Where the party gonna hell? Out in the St. John's swamps. Sasquatch doing a brand new dance, and he called it the Bigfoot Stomp.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Marco Bill on the Bigfoot Live broadcast. And folks, it's that time of the week again. It's time for the Wednesday evening Bigfoot Live radio show with our host, Mr. Tom Viscardi. And now, everybody, the man who put the big back into Bigfoot, our host and renowned Bigfoot researcher, Mr. Tom Viscardi. Good evening, Tom. How are you tonight?
Well, hello, everybody. Happy Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving to all of our listeners out there, our family and our friends. Tom is on an expedition right now. He won't be back until mid-December. And he's out of pocket and out of cell phone range. But I'll try to keep you apprised of what's going on here as time progresses. What I'd like to do is I'd like to thank a lot of you good people out there for giving me calls, emails, other things for some of our shows. A lot of good questions that you've asked. We had some people on here, our last show here, that we talked about the Patterson-Gimlin film, and we had the author of a book. We had several other people on here. Leroy Blevins has done a lot of work on investigating the film and its authenticity and everything else. Now, what I thought, we didn't have a lot of time last week or the week before to really cover a lot of things. So what I did is I asked Leroy to come back, because Leroy is a wealth of information on those films. I mean, he absolutely has everything you can think of that he's done on that. I could not get the pictures up on the website. I don't know. There's something wrong with. Actually, it's nothing wrong with Leroy's stuff. It's something wrong with my stuff that I got to figure out what's wrong. But I will get it up there. But tonight, as we talk about it, I want to describe the photos and everything, and then we'll go on from there. I'd like to thank a couple of people that called me during the week here. JD gave me a call, and he had a sighting, and he was pretty excited about that. Christian, our little friend, our 13-year-old friend from last week, called me several times. He's had some more things happening, and he asked me for some information. I sent him some information so he could do a little more research on it, and he's going out there and taking a look at things. And he's taking a look at some of the trees for the tree twists. He's looking around for footprints, or if he can't, the leaf litter is kind of bad in his area there. That's what prevents him from that. But he's looking for all different kinds of things that he put together. He's seen some things that some of our good folks here have been on and described. And so what he's done is he's went out there looking for those very same things. So thank him a lot, and I hope he does well. Anyway, tonight what I'd like to do is we'll just start the show out here. Let's go talk to our good friend Leroy Blevins. Leroy, how are you tonight, my friend?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing, Marco?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Well, a couple weeks ago we had you on, and we didn't really have a lot of time. You're part of it, but you had so many things that you've done. Now, what I've done is basically, you know those two files that you sent me?
Yes.
Okay, I have both of those files, and what I'd like to do is go through the pictures of those things. I'll describe them to the people, and then you can describe what took place. I think you must have this pretty much memorized, right?
Yeah.
Well, the first one is people who were in the. A lot of people don't realize, and you brought this to light, that this was not an. This was actually a documentary that they were trying to make, and it ended up being two or three different films, right?
Yes.
And what they were trying to do is there are certain people in each one of these films, and you've brought to light all the difficulties when they tried to blend pictures in. For instance, the same scene in the fall, same scene in the spring, mixed in the same picture, and you did that through color variation. And the first picture was. You know, who are the people, the cast for his documentary film? And what I have here is Roger Patterson, John Ballard, right?
Yes.
Jerry Merritt, Howard Hieronymus, Bob Gimlin, and Bob Hieronymus.
Yeah.
Now, Howard Hieronymus is Bob Hieronymus' father, right?
His brother.
Now, in that image, you have a picture of all those guys together on horses in the famous area where they had that first part of their film, right?
Well, that image was taken 15 miles up behind Bob Hieronymus' house.
Uh-huh. Now, the cast images of the men as seen in the PG film. But basically what you've got some other pictures that they kind of slipped in there, right?
Yes.
One is Roger, you got the one of Roger Patterson. They've got a Bob Hieronymus and Jerry Merritt. And Jerry Merritt, of course, is wearing a blue shirt.
Is that Jerry Merritt is one has a coat on.
Oh, yes, right. It's a coat. You're right.
And because that film was like bluish. Different copies of the film.
Yeah.
And then Roger Patterson, which has a striped shirt on, which you see also in that photo. And then we got Bob Hieronymus with his white shirt on and his black vest on.
Now, the only people that we see in the PG film was Bob Hieronymus, Jerry Merritt, and Roger Patterson, right?
Yes.
But they claim that Bob Ginlan was seen in the film. Of course, that wasn't true.
No, the man
that they called was Bob Ginlan was actually Roger Patterson with a blue shirt.
Yes. Because, see, the striped shirt scene was with Roger Patterson having the striped shirt on. That was added back to the film in 1968.
Uh-huh.
The original film would just show Roger Patterson with the blue shirt on, and that was it.
Mm. And the first one was 1967, though, right?
Yes. That was that's from the original film. But then what people don't know is they remade the film in 1968. Ron Olson did of A&E.
Right.
And that's the film we see today.
And that's the one we see. And basically this thing has been spliced together quite a few times.
Yes.
And what they've done is to make things longer, they've taken different scenes and slapped them in to make it look like it's a longer duration film, correct?
Yes. Now, see, like with the Bigfoot part of the film, too, they actually, there's two different sequences there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've got the frames that you showed basically were lining up the color elements of each of the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And you had two scenes that did not line up with the rest of the color elements. And so what you did is you took them frame by frame, in the lineup, and you basically, in your document, you line the color elements up so that you tell them where they match. And there's about, 12 pictures, 12 of the pictures on the scenes are the same color elements in one aspect, and then there's six in the second portion that are a different color element but are the same color elements.
Yes.
And one is more light.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just describing it, and you can go further into detail.
Okay.
But the one with the larger number of color pictures in the color element is a lighter kind of a shade. A lighter kind of a color element, and then the one with the six pictures is a darker color element, more dark red, more reds in the trees and other things like that. That's in it. Can you tell us what all that means?
Okay, what I did was, as you notice, I break them down in scenes.
Yes.
Okay, through the whole film, there's six scenes. So what I did was I took match up the color elements of each scene and put them back in order the way it's supposed to be. And then as we do that, we find out that they added scene 5 and scene 3 and scene 5 into the film because they're the two scenes that have different color elements.
Right.
And the one they added into the film was Roger Patterson with the striped shirt on. That's scene number 3. And then scene number 5 is the first time we see the Bigfoot walking in the film.
Yep.
Then was taken from the same role of another film as the other four scenes was taken from another film.
Wow. So when you looked in and you put all this stuff together, you separated the color elements and put them to what they were, and then you actually put them in where they put them together to make a different... a different film.
They
spliced portions of it in there to add to the film. Now, the two scenes that were added to the film, they were added to the film when, in 1968?
Yes.
The second time, right?
Yes.
And then the original film only showed Roger Patterson with the blue shirt in the second part of the Bigfoot walking.
Well, according to John Green, though, he told me something different. because I asked him about the original film, because he's the only one that's around today to actually seen the original film. I asked him what was on original film, and he sat there and he says, all the film contained it was someone riding on horseback and scenery. Then there's a section of the Bigfoot walking, and then after that there's more scenery and someone riding horseback. So basically, in the original film, the Bigfoot was not walking at the end of the film. He was walking in the middle of the film.
I see. So when Ron Olson did this in 1968, they added those two scenes back into the film to make it longer and then to throw the people off by saying that the man in the blue shirt was Bob Gimlin. In fact, it was Roger Patterson.
Yes. Well, see, what's so funny about it is when you look at the films, you will see that when Roger Patterson has a blue shirt on, and he's still riding the same horse that you see him with the striped shirt on.
Right.
I mean, the same saddle. He's even wearing the same hat.
Same hat, same everything, yeah.
Yeah, same. He has the same hat on, same blue shirt. He's wearing his hat the same way. He's the same height as the man on the horse. That's why when we see Roger Patterson with the blue shirt on, you always see him from the backside. You never see him from the side profile or anything else. You always see him from the backside.
Got it. And then there's one where you show him with the, where you can see his face. But as you see, Roger was on the same horse with a short tail.
Mm-hmm.
And he has on the same clothes and hat. He's even wearing the hat the same way. Plus, it's got, as you said, the same saddle.
Mm-hmm.
And the man they claimed Bob Gimlin was actually Roger Patterson.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you also look at the left hand of the Bigfoot is open, there's a picture of that film, and on the left hand you see that there's left of the Bigfoot is open, and as you see the left hand, it looks like the catcher's mitt, and the left hand lines up with a bear paw. Can you explain that? Tell us about that.
All right. When I was looking at close-ups of the hand, okay, people don't understand that hand was opened up three times in the film. You can see it. Every time that hand comes back, the left hand opens up all the way. Well, it looks like a catcher's mitt. So as I was lining up, from what Bob Cronin says, you know, he says the suit smelled like a dead carcass. You know, like a dead horse hide or something.
Yeah.
So when I was sitting there looking over the fur on the Bigfoot and the left hand and stuff, everything lined up with a bear hide. The hand, left hand lines up with a bear paw, and the fur on the suit also matches up with a bear hide as well.
So that means there's actually more than one suit.
Yes.
The one that Philip Morris made.
Well,
and
see,
then
the one,
another one.
Yeah, the one that Philip Morris made, though.
Yeah.
That was used in Ron Olson's film.
Right.
Sasquatch, the Legend of Bigfoot. Matter of fact, Al Diatley still has that suit.
But now this one is made out of bear skin.
Yes.
Yeah, right?
Mm-hmm. And the man that made the suit was Bob Titmuss.
Uh-huh.
He's a taxidermist. Well, that's what he would do. He was. He was a taxidermist. And if you think about it, he's the only one to get a hold of bear hide fast. And then
right. If
you look at the seam that comes around the hip, where the leg comes up, well, that's how they do it, because that's how I made my suit, is because you have to study how a taxidermy does, you know, bears and stuff to make them look real and everything else. And that's what he did.
Uh-huh.
They show the same trademarks as a taxidermist does.
Yeah, and I can see that what you did is you matched the fur.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the same as from the black bear. It's the same doggone thing. Now, there was another thing that you did is Bob Hieronymus in his walk.
Mm-hmm.
I could tell it in the very, very beginning. You know, Bob Hieronymus, when he walks, I mean, when you see that creature walking, it's Bob Hieronymus.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, there's nobody that can walk like that.
Well, if you
that
watch,
I'm aware
you watch his feet motions too. Feet motions
yeah.
are the same way as Bob Hieronymus as well.
Yeah, and what you do is you point out how he moves his right foot or left foot.
His right foot.
His right foot, and he's mm-hmm. kind of at an angle, and it's the same all the time. And it's pretty neat the way you've done that. Now, I'd often try to figure out how could you show that. Because
mm-hmm.
I knew it. I mean, I was seeing Bob Hieronymus and meeting, you know, looking at him, right, in the films and stuff, and how he walked regular, and then how a creature walked in the film. It was exactly the same. And I couldn't see anybody else walking like that. I mean, that's a very, very unique walk.
Yeah, it is.
And, but anyway... So then there was that was one factor in it, and then another factor there's a clear frame from the PG film, and you said that in the clear frame, the blurry images that they took out of the film, and there were some blurry images in there, right?
Yes.
And then they said that was an S tree that made the blurry image in the film.
Yes.
But what you did is you took a look. And you took the S tree and did a side by side of the S tree and the blurry image, and they didn't even match.
No.
So then you took the S tree is taller than the blurry image, and of course they don't line up with one another either. So now what you did is you took a side profile of John Green
mm-hmm.
from the tracking dog film, right?
Yes.
And you did a side by side view. And they're the same shape and size.
Mm-hmm.
Then you overlaid John Green over the blurry image. And it matched.
Yeah.
So what they were doing was trying to take him out of the film, right?
Yes. Because you could see the image when he is actually in play. You could see this image walk across and bends down out of frame. And then when I was looking over at the tracking dog film, it's like if you watch John Green walk, you can see he walks in this S shape.
Right.
So that's why I went ahead and took his image and trying to see if that was the image that they seen in the film, you know, the blurry image, because they said, well, it's the S tree, but even in the clear frames, you should see that tree, but you don't. You still see this blurry out image. So they were doing editing to it, and they was taking somebody out.
My gosh, well, see, look at all the stuff that you've done. And, I mean, you have many, many, many more. I mean, there's so much more.
I got files after files.
Oh, my God. I mean, it's just, and all of these, I mean, the footprints, all of those things that you've shown proof. What really amazed me is you found the soundtrack on a portion of the film with the actual title from A&E on the trailer on the end of the trailer.
Yeah.
And this is supposed to be the original, you know, what, 68mm, 16mm, 8mm film.
See, just like the Kodachrome film.
Yeah.
The Kodachrome film is what they printed on in 1968. That's not what
right.
the original film was.
Right.
The original film was a cheap 16mm film that they had developed. Which a lot of researchers don't know this, but I did because, you know, I do my tracking and I make sure I find out where it came from. It's Alpha Cinema in Seattle, Washington, is the one that developed the film for them.
My gosh. That's amazing. And then, of course, you brought out the timeline last week, or, you know, the timeline of what happened and everything, and, of course, that all sort of makes it fall through, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, just like first interview that they gave them, Bob and Gimlin and Roger Patterson, in the first interview they did that night, we're talking Friday, October 20th, and it was printed in the next day's newspaper, where they claimed that even Bob Gimlin's horse ran off.
Oh, my God.
So now there's, you know, two guys sitting in the middle of nowhere with their horses gone.
Yeah. I love it. Well, I just have to, what I got to tell you is I can't believe how much work you've done on this. I mean, this is a lot. I mean, there's a portion in there where you see Bob Gimlin behind the bush, and it's real blurry at first. But when you bring it out, show a picture of Bob Gimlin next to it, it is unmistakably Bob Gimlin.
Yeah. Well, see, that's why I never did understand how all these researchers missed that all these years. Because that's the same thing when I did my JFK assassination. I mean, I found 13 shots, and, you know, I found other gunmen, and I got images of them. How did they miss it?
Yeah. Amazing. Well, gosh, you know, for ladies and gentlemen, you got to understand, this whole thing, in all the work that Leroy has done, is on one of our films. And it's called The Hoax of the Century. And if you haven't seen it, go out and get it. It's really worthwhile. It shows everything we're talking about and more in a greater detail. Right, Leroy?
Yeah.
And it goes through the whole, I mean, it goes through the whole thing. It goes through the receipts of, you know, for cameras, the receipts, the logbook. I mean, all this stuff with the pilot and the aircraft, where they went. I mean, so many different aspects of this thing that were brought to light and that were, that bring it into, that this was a very, very well orchestrated hoax. And it was meant to be from the very beginning. I mean, it was made to make money. And that's what they did. And there was no truth to any of the stuff that they had in it. It was just all brought on to, and they did for how many years now? And now, the problem really is that there's so many people out there, and we were some of them. I mean, we were people. That was our holy grail as far as starting out, was looking at that film and all this all these years. But when we found out all this stuff and put it together several times, not just once. I mean, 4, 5, or 6 years ago. How long have you been working on this one?
Years. Yeah, since 2005 I started working on it.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I remember our first big 4-hour show we had on that?
Yes.
You were on, and we had all, I mean, we had Bob Aronimus, we had everybody on there, and it was amazing. But anyway, ladies and gentlemen, what we're not trying to do is we're not trying to destroy anybody's, the truth. What we're trying to do is bring the truth out. And the truth is that the Patterson-Gimlin film is a fake and a hoax. And it was brought on like that. And they knew it, and it wasn't that they, you know, did all this deception and stuff. That was their intention from the beginning, was to do that. And, it, you know, just because he got on the Johnny Carson show and he was able to get out there, whatever he could do to promote, that's what they did. And they had these, what do they call them, these screenings in these different cities and areas. And, man, they were making money hand over fist at all these different screenings. He was getting all this free advertising from the television. And so it was a pretty good thing. And they made a lot of money from it. And there was a lot of people involved in it. And some of those people are people that we revere today as Bigfoot experts. But are they? I don't know. Well, and I'm not trying to break down their reputation as a Bigfoot expert, but their involvement in this was not true. And that's all we're trying to say. We're not trying to say anything more or anything less than the truth. And that's what Leroy has brought out. And Leroy, I have to thank you from the bottom of my heart. All these years, you have shared things with me and, explained things to me. And my gosh, you are one heck of a researcher, I'm going to tell you right now.
Well,
you really do your job very well. You're very, very, very meticulous in everything you do. And I really appreciate. I don't know if there's, you spent a lot of hours, you have virtually nothing to show for it monetarily,
no,
other than your own hard work. And I just want to let you know personally that that I appreciate everything you've done, and I really respect you a lot for all that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I want to thank you for coming on. Well, I want to thank you for coming on tonight, and I want to wish you and your family a very happy Thanksgiving. And are you going to stay on for a while? And we'll, at the end of the show there, we'll just kind of open it up and everybody say something to each other?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was Leroy Blevins, and he's going to be with us at the end of the show here. I'm going to quickly go for a commercial, real quick-like.
In August 2008, there was an announcement that was heard around the globe. A promise of the end to an age-long mystery and deception that played out on the world stage. Anatomy of a Bigfoot Hoax. Now, for the first time ever, see with your own eyes and hear the true behind-the-scenes story of the hoax that gripped the world. Featuring original, never-before-seen footage. Available now at searchingforbigfoot.com.
One, they're very sick people, but you know what bothers me more than anything, Megan? These guys were the law.
Well, we're back, everybody, and now we're going to go out here to Four Corners, New Mexico, to our good buddy Dave. Dave, how are you?
I'm doing good, Marco Bill. How you doing?
Super. Happy Thanksgiving, Dave.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving to you, too, and all the listeners, too.
Well, tell us what's transpiring in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, I've been talking to a woman up in Colorado, just across the border. I live about 20 miles from the south of the border, New Mexico, so I commute back and forth quite a bit into that direction, and happened to find a contact of a Bigfoot sighting, actual sighting. She saw the whole thing. She gave me a story that actually happened last year north of Durango in a mining district. These are the San Juan Mountains and of Colorado, southwest Colorado. There's a lot of tall mountains up to 14,000 feet and a lot of mining in the area, too, that goes along with it. Well, her and her family went camping last year and told me that they camped in a meadow. And I guess on one side of it, there's kind of a newer house that had been built not too long ago. And it's, but the meadow is public property, but apparently the owner didn't think it was public. And, well, he didn't want people around. And I'll get to that in just a minute. But basically when she, I guess they were hearing a lot of strange noises and yells and stuff. And finally they got a flashlight out. It was already dark. Got a flashlight out, and at the mine entrance across from the meadow, they saw a Bigfoot stick. You know, its whole body was out of the outside of the mine shaft. And she said they flashlighted it, and it hit it right in the eyes. It was just deep red eyes, just extremely deep. And they were pretty freaked out about it, but they stayed their ground, and they camped out overnight. They stayed the night, but this thing seemed, they could feel it, that it was around the area, that it was actually circling the meadow, and there may have been actually more of them. They weren't too sure. But in this spot, this area they were in, I had a friend that had a similar encounter too. They didn't actually see it, but they had boulders thrown at them, screams and yells, and just a really, actually a bad time. You know, he didn't know what it was. He thought it was just some wild man or something that was yelling at them. And he said he saw the back of it a little bit before it got too dark, and it looked kind of dark, he said, but he really couldn't get a good eye on it. But he said what was really, besides the rock throwing, what was so scary and compelling was the screaming. The loudness of the screaming was horrible. So I got my friend on, and actually there are two friends. They actually live in my neighborhood here. So I got them on the internet. It was quite a while back, and we found some sounds purported to be Bigfoot, and they finally locked it in. It was a scream sound. Sounded kind of like a monkey howling, but just much louder volume and different tones all mixed in. So this area, and then that gal, let's see, I saw her last Friday. She told me there was another report she heard from somebody, another one of her friends in that same exact area. So when the snows finally melt, I think we're going to take a little investigation, me and Brenda and whoever we can take.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Kind of right now, it's the mountains are pretty much closed down because of the snow and everything, right?
Right, yeah. In fact, in that area, they've got between 35 and 45 inches now. So
wow.
I could probably snowshoe or backcountry ski it in there, or even snow. Well, I don't have a snowmobile, but that's
yeah,
probably...
Yeah, a lot of avalanches and stuff too, right?
Yeah. In fact, right next to that mine shaft is an avalanche slope right there. It's full of talus rock in the summer. And she also told me that on that rock, on that talus slope, there were actually large footprints and big strides right there. She said they were very visible the next morning. And they said that, I was going to finish that story. She said that the owner didn't like them to camp there. It's public land. But it was, I guess what he was doing is putting, like, Jason masks and all kinds of weird things. He put on the road there, the little access road, he put like a body bag that was filled with all kinds of stuff in it. When you open it up, it showed a portrait of the guy that owned the house. Now,
yeah.
And she told me they went up there this summer. They didn't see anything this year, but they noticed the house was for sale. There's a for sale sign now, so I think that thing probably looked in its window or just scared him. You know, there's probably something to do with the Bigfoot.
Oh my gosh!
Gosh.
But
Now you've been getting together with Linda here pretty frequently, right?
Yeah, Brenda.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been talking to her on a regular basis, and she got a picture of some footprints right there not too far from her house.
So,
and I saw
them
on Facebook today. I was like, oh, wow, that was a really nice footprint. I think she casted that one because I saw the cast of it. It didn't
mm-hmm.
It didn't happen too recently. I think it was like about a couple of months ago. But, yeah, it was the activity. I talked to her actually just a few days ago, and she said the activity seems to be increasing again. It actually slowed down for a while, and it's
right.
coming back up. More reports coming in.
Wow. Well, and it's all probably based on the weather and things like that, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's getting colder here. We had our first snowfall about 3 days ago. Well, actually, just like 3 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
We had that major storm that's now in the East Coast that everybody's so worried about was here during that time and dropped about between 3 and 4 feet of snow in the San Juan Mountains out here. So
wow.
Everything's going winter, but I think it slows down the Bigfoot activity usually, but we're still hearing about it, especially in the lower lands. So we're keeping our eyes and ears open.
Yeah, when they're looking for food, other than in the mountains and the orchards and things that are the natural ones out there that they had out there, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they also have a lot of farmers in the area.
Yes,
in their fields and stuff, the corn and all the other stuff that they, during the summer and in the fall, but during the winter, is there anything, I mean, what's available that you're aware of, too?
Yeah, there's actually, right at the bottom of the mountains, which it can snow about 2 to 3 feet, at this time, a lot of the deer and elk have come down off the mountain, so they're in those fields, actually, just below the Rockies there.
Yeah.
And we also notice that these deer and elk migrate across the border as the winter gets more harsh. So at this moment, they're still mostly, quite a few on the Colorado side. Some have already migrated because we're starting to see, the deer hunters and stuff talk about it. But that's kind of an area I want to actually check out, maybe in the evenings here very soon. Some of those fields where especially the elk, it seems like the Bigfoot does like elk meat. And it tastes pretty good.
yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Well, anything in elk, I mean, all tastes good.
Yeah, and I had an area actually a lot closer, just right at the very edge of the Rockies here, where, let's see, we were getting some reports, and I was noticing a lot of tree formations. I have a feeling that those Bigfoot have moved farther south, and possibly in those fields. But they're definitely here, too, and we still think that there is a migratory pattern from there to our river basin, since they're pretty common. And
wow.
I actually went to a riverine park here inside the city limits, and I did find some stick formations, and I did find a footprint. I'm going to go out there tomorrow and take a picture of it. It's kind of in a muddy area where the snow has melted, so it looks at least to be several days old during the time that the storm was really hitting hard here. But 3 weeks ago, I was actually there at Berg Park. I have a police scanner, and I was listening to it, and there was a report of some fake animal calls and screaming sounds coming from the park that we have. So I went out there, and the moment I got to one of the parking lots, there was a cop already there, and he said, "Yeah, I'm taking the report, but I don't want to go in there." He says, "I heard a few of those sounds, and I'm all alone tonight, so I'm not going to go in there." And he says, "I don't want you to go in there anyway." So. And I actually did have my digital recorder, and I was talking to Brenda on the phone. I could actually hear myself on the recording. Well, the surprising thing is once that I did hear one yell. It was more of a growling yell come from that river park. And right at that moment when I played back the recording, it was kind of a screech and a static and wind sound, and all that didn't seem to be happening at that moment that I had that recorder on. And as soon as the scream was over, the yell, you could just hear me, Brenda and I continue talking. So, because I could even hear her say, "Yeah, is the recorder on?" I said, "Yeah, it's working fine." You know, it's like,
wow.
I get home, so it's almost like a dampening field or something.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, gosh, thanks so much for coming on and telling us and bringing us up to speed with what's going on there.
Oh, you bet.
And I'll keep in touch with you here in the next week, and we'll, you know.
That sounds great, Marco Bill.
See what's going on. Thank you so much for all your, for everything you do for us all the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Happy Thanksgiving to you and your family and Brenda and all the other folks out there.
Thank you. Yeah, you too, Marco Bill. Happy Thanksgiving to all of you, your family, and everybody out there on Radioland.
Well, thank you. I'm going to mute you out now, but you're going to stay until the end, right?
Yep, sure will.
Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it was Dave Ortiz from Four Corners, and we're going to go right out here back to Richard from New York. Richard, how are you tonight?
I'm wonderful, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing great.
That's wonderful.
Well, Richard, you know, there's a few things have been going on in the last couple of weeks. Why don't you bring us up to speed?
Well, I sent you that video.
I got it. And what I'm going to try to do is post that. The reason I want to post it is because it shows a really, really good view of what you're looking at when you go down that trail and what
yes.
it looks like and what the brush and all the other stuff are.
It's a very unique ecosystem, Bill. We actually had the day I was in there, there was a moose, a male moose, that had been taken from that general area a day after that.
Wow.
So even though it's in the middle of an urban area, it's pretty wild, as you could see, right?
Oh, yeah, no.
When I get to the end, you know, I'm talking to myself, that's sand. Where you see those tracks?
Yeah, I've seen that.
That was a huge lake that had been there maybe 30,000-40,000 years ago.
Yeah,
it's actually huge sand dunes in there, and I'm walking on the left hand side of the trail where that white tree where I stop. There's like a game trail that goes up there. I won't
yeah.
go. And that goes up to the part that I call it the Tom Biscardi Sasquatch Preserve. Because the reason that's closed off
yeah.
is because I called the show.
Uh-huh.
That goes up to like a hill. And on the other side of the trail, it's a city landfill. So you can see why they would be there.
Sure.
There's plenty of food on the other side. I did go up I did follow a trail that day right up to the landfill. It goes straight up through. There's actually a path worn.
Well, it also looks like you've got some various tree formations as well in there.
Oh, yeah. It's a very wild place. It's a neat place. And I hit this. I try to do the same area over. A lot of people don't do that. We got one person here, a notable person. He's running all over the Adirondacks, I guess, looking in that huge park, the Adirondack Park, for something. I mean, it's like finding a needle in a haystack.
Yeah.
You know, unless you have, like Tom will get a call and he'll try to get there as soon as he can. If you're not there right after it happens, you're not going to, the chances of finding something are pretty difficult.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, unless it's in an area where they're, you know, where they're pretty active all the time. And then,
this is a habituation site. They're being kept there.
Yeah.
I can, in this preserve, Bill, they have a what they call an activity center.
Yeah.
It's as nice as any learning museum facility you could ever find, research facility. And who do you think is paying? They got, those trails are so well maintained, as you can see, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're beautifully maintained and marked. They have a lot of employees. And who's paying for that? They never ask for donations in this area for this place. Ever, ever, ever.
Wow.
And the first time I ever called your show, I called Tom on a Sunday and told him that I had had a sighting where it went right across the trail in front of me.
Yeah.
I just thought of something while I was sitting here. You know, Bill, I had heard conversation between two individuals in the part where I can't go anymore, the preserve, what I call the and one day I was in there and I got growled at. And it didn't sound like no four-foot animal growling at me. It wasn't real loud, but it was a growl, like a warning growl, like a dog might give. Not when they're really aggressive, but they're just like letting you know. And I forgot all about that. But somebody's paying them to keep that place the way it is. Because it used to be nothing. It used to be nothing, Bill. Nothing. I'm telling you, there was no building, there was no park, there was no parking lot with 50 employees in it.
Well, that's pretty interesting, isn't it?
and the trail where I can't go anymore was, I was up in Maine. I called you guys from Maine on Thursday. We stayed in Maine Thursday. On Monday, I went back to go on the trail that I was, that I said that I had the sighting on, that I talked to Tom about, told him where I had the sighting.
Yeah.
Told him the trail. There's a sign up that the trail's closed. So I walk all the way. I do a circular route all the way around to the back end of the trail because they run in circles in the preserve.
Yeah.
You know, you can't. And there's a sign there. The only two places in the whole preserve that there's a sign up that you can't go on the trail. There's no reason for not being able to go on that trail because the trail is just like every other trail in there. There's no danger. There's no, you know, slides or anything. There's no reason for it not to be open other than there's something there. And I can give you... And if you do go over that, nobody goes over my stuff like I do. I'll sit there for hours and I try to talk myself out of what I see. I don't want to just jump in like Leroy was just talking about the Patterson film.
Yeah.
You know and I know, no, if you see a Sasquatch, it's not going to walk parallel to the trail if it knows you're there and turn around and look back at you and just casually walk off. They're going to head for the brush, and you ain't going to see them again. You're going to get 2 seconds, 3 seconds. You're not going to get that casual walk away looking over the shoulder, right?
Yeah. No, I would agree, yeah.
And it's going to be so fast that if you blink, you're not going to see it. Because my other sighting that I had that wasn't in this preserve was maybe 3 seconds. It was perfect. And the thing didn't look like what's in the Patterson film. Because nothing, you've been out there with Tom. I don't think they're barrel bodied like that. They might be huge and they might be big, but they're more athletic than that built. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they're thinner.
The one I saw was built more like a Chippendale dancer than a gorilla. You know, muscular and athletic and lean.
Well, just look at the picture that you sent me from before. Look at the chest.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Well, anyway, you're going to keep taking a look at things, right?
Yeah, you know what? I'm hoping I get... I'm going to buy myself one of those... what do they, pro the camera that you mount on a hat?
Yeah.
Or on a vest? GoPro. GoPro camera?
Yeah.
I'm going to get one or two of those things, and I'm going to start using those. Maybe one frontwards and one backwards with my little handheld movie camera. I'm going to try to cover more area than I'm covering because you miss a lot when you're moving. And
yeah.
I think the only way you get stuff is by them not thinking you're taking their picture. These little
well, I'm going to post that the video that you sent me. I just it was an 89 meg file, and I had a hard time uploading it.
It did come out pretty good, though. I mean,
no, it did. It'll show everybody what the terrain looks like exactly. What you're talking about.
It does look kind of squatchy, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If you look.
Yeah, it does. It's pretty good. Well, thank you, Richard, for coming on tonight and sharing with us.
Absolutely, Bill. Anytime. And I
happy
hope
Thanksgiving
you
to you and your
yeah,
family.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving to you and your family too. I mean, it's the family time of year.
Yep, and I'll keep in touch with you through the week.
Thank you, Bill.
Okay, thanks for coming on, Richard. You're going to wait here for a few minutes at the end of the show, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was Richard from New York. And now we're going to go out to Rocky and Swede. And tonight on...
Hey.
How you doing, Rocky? How you doing, Swede?
I'm doing good.
Well, tonight on Footnotes, we're going to talk about first aid, huh?
Yeah, we thought that would be a pretty good idea. Are you there, Swede?
I think I got him. I'm showing him on here.
Well, he may have gone to sleep. Now, the Swede came over to the restaurant the other day, and me and him had a business arrangement set up. He showed up, and the first thing he saw was blood all over the sidewalk. So he eased into the business and found blood leading all the way back into the back room. Well, he was kind of nervous. He had his gun in his hand. Of course, I was watching him on camera. Well, when he came into the back room, I was standing in there. I had cut my finger to the bone, and I had been hosing blood all over the place. And so, of course, he wanted to sew me up.
And wanted to fix it, right?
Well, the first thing he noticed when he got there is the tailgate of my truck was down, and that my all possible box, I got an old 50 caliber a box for 50 caliber machine gun ammo that's got everything that you can imagine, and it was standing open. So when he came in, I had my first aid kit in there trying to put my finger back together. And, of course, he wanted to sew it up, but I'd already super glued it by the time he got there. And that was not a pleasant experience. But anyhow, we were talking about it, and, you know, we spend so much time out in the woods doing and knocking around. We always, always have first aid kits. Well, there's a lot of stuff out there that, you know, the natural remedies and all that, but you got to find them. Well, with first aid kit, you got to open it. The Swede, the first aid kit he brings out to the camp with him is kind of like a fold-out emergency room. I mean, it's got everything. But we've been down through the brush, and you know, when it's late, we've walked through sawbriars, we've walked into bow dart trees, bad stuff, and so you know, we were talking earlier about you know, the first aid kit. Well, you know, Benadryl, wonderful thing. You know, you want, with the first aid kit, you want, one thing that you have to have is lots and lots of tape, lots and lots of gauze. We have aspirins. We got out the one time and I crashed my four-wheeler, and when Robert found me, I broke my arm in two places, my shoulder in four places. Well, we couldn't actually put me back together, but he patched me up enough that we could get back out to camp. It's like 6 miles from camp up through the brush. My four-wheeler was completely destroyed, so I had to come out on the back end of his. But when I got up there, he had half a handful of baby aspirins, and he had to tear his T-shirt, the tail of his T-shirt off to tie my shoulder in place for the trip out. After that, we started paying more attention to what was going on. Sawbriars, falls, walking through the woods, the wet woods, and stepping on leaves on top of a slick rock. Lots of broken bones, all that kind of stuff happens too often. And out where we are, without a good first aid kit, we could be in really, really bad trouble. And so we started gathering up our first aid kit. Well, the main thing, you can go to any Army surplus store and get a cheap one. You can go to Wally World and get a cheap first aid kit. You can get just, you know, the Dollar Saver store. You can get a first aid kit that has a little bit of everything, most everything that you need. Ours is expanded to knee braces and slings and splints, and we had to get the one four-wheeler guy out. He crashed his four-wheeler and was laying down in the bottoms with a broken leg, and so his buddy came up there, and we followed him down, and we splinted the guy's leg, and, well, he was going to have to ride out on the back of his buddy's motorcycle, so we always have lots and lots of paracord. So with our paracord, we made basically just a frame so that he could sit on the back of the four-wheeler, and we made a frame out of sticks and stuff that was attached to the rack on the four-wheeler, so we keep his leg immobilized, and they finally got him out of there. But aspirins, sting, bug stings, bug bites, snake bites. Benadryl is a wonderful thing to have. Aspirins are a wonderful thing to have unless you have an allergy, and then you can take Tylenol. Lots and lots of gauze. We've got enough duct tape and the like in our first aid kit to, I don't know, we could tape up half the world. but we've found it to be very invaluable, and it works really good for splinting people up. Blood clotting agent, wonderful thing to have. Robert's kit, you know, we could do surgery with his kit. He's got everything. We don't carry that one. We don't carry that one. We have simpler first aid kits, but we have a little bit of everything because so many times we've had accidents, and we've found other people that had accidents that were really happy to see us. But one of the things we take in the big first aid kit, water is number one. We always have a .22 pistol that we can use to secure food with. That's two things in our first aid kit. Everything else is more medical. Lots and lots of paracord, lots and lots of tape, lots and lots of gauze, and read the book that comes with first aid kits. One of the worst things I've ever seen was an old boy that stepped on a bow dart briar, a sticker. It went through his boot, and he got it out, but there was just about a 30-second long piece that broke off inside his foot, which ended up causing him to have lots of surgery on his foot. But the necessity, I don't care if you're getting 75 feet off the road, if you're outside of the road, you should have an emergency kit, a first aid kit, at least the very basics. So many times that we've had to tape up fingers or super glue fingers, and super glue works really good for some pretty nasty cuts if you can get the bleeding stopped. Rubber bands. we usually split our own, the ones that we carry with us, we usually split into two, separate everything into Ziploc bags, put the Ziploc bags into large freezer bags. We usually take quite a few of those. But it's like the man said, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Well, it's worth a ton of cure when you're way out like that, because the slightest little scratch can turn septic. And, you know, if you're in a situation, when it turns septic, it can cause problems that will last you the rest of your life.
You know what, Rocky? Well, let's open it up now for everybody. You know, have everybody put everybody on there. Maybe they have some input or questions, too. I got Richard and Dave. Steve, you're there.
Yeah, I'm here now.
So what do you say to, you know, Rocky's pretty much, Rocky and Sweet have been, of course, they've had a lot of experience out there in the places where there aren't anybody. And
right.
When you get hurt when you're out there, there's nowhere to go. There's no hospital to go to, for sure. So,
how do you deal with ticks?
Ticks? I've got some stuff, and I can't think of the name of it right now. You can spray it on your clothes, and it's good for about 6 weeks.
Yeah.
But you don't want to spray it on yourself.
About thistle root?
No, this stuff is it's easier. It's just in a can. I can't think the name of it now. That's not good. Anyhow, it sprays on your, not supposed to spray it on your skin, just on your clothes, mm-hmm. and it'll last for weeks.
So say you got your boots or your shoes, and you put your socks over your pants, right? And you take the spray and you spray the over the whole deal, right?
Well, what we usually do is before we go, we'll hose it all down and put it in a plastic bag and just leave it outside. And that way it's all ready to go, because, like I say, once you spray it on there, it's good for about six weeks. I'm not going to wear the same clothes that long, but I could. But as far as the tick bite, that's a whole different thing. If you've already been bit, you've got to be really, really careful. I got tick fever several years ago, and it was the most, it's the sickest I've ever been in my life. And it was one of those things. I missed 3 months of work, mm-hmm. which I've never done before in my life. But whenever you go to getting a tick out, tweezers work best. And
a bleach.
If you got a Bic lighter, you can heat that tweezer up and just get a hold of the tick. And as soon as the warm tweezers hit it, he'll start to back out. So there's a lot better chance of getting the head out.
Hey, Rocky.
Yeah.
I tell you something else that works better than a tweezer. Is there a flame or just an ash of a cigarette? That's a cap full of bleach.
Well, that would work.
They'll back out and won't leave their head in you either.
Well, that's one of those things, another thing to put in the first aid kit.
Yeah. And if you ever get sick with that fever, whatever the ticks give you, you go online and you buy yourself some pure Tissel root. And you take two drops every day, and it'll help get rid of that fever.
Well, it was about 3 days after the bite, it may have been longer than that, before I actually started getting any kind of symptoms. Anyhow, the doctor said it was ehrlichiosis. Anyhow, it was one of those things. I couldn't put clothes on. I couldn't stand for anything to touch my skin. He gave me some what he calls super antibiotic, and he said he could only give it to me the one time. And he said then it was just a waiting game. And oddly enough, this is the doctor that didn't give me anything when I had my shoulder broke in 4 places and my arm in 2. He gave me pain medicine for that. I didn't ever take it.
Like the doctor was a quack job.
Oh no, he's extremely good. He just doesn't. He's like me. He doesn't believe in pain medicine. You know, the pain will go away eventually. But
sounds like my wife. Jesus, nails.
Now we got to go to sleep sometime. God,
my doctor he's kind of a country doctor. He tells me that if it hurts real bad, just to rub it. That's one of the reasons I go to him, is because, you know, it's got to be, you know, you could go in there with, I can't. He gives pain medicine to my daughter and my son and my wife and all that, but when I go in there, he just figures I can handle it. So he just says, you know, well, don't do that anymore, and it won't hurt anymore. So,
yeah.
But
I tell you, if you ever want to get rid of that, if you ever get that Rocky Mountain fever or whatever the hell they call it,
yeah,
do some research on that Tissel. That Tissel root will actually help you get rid of it.
Well, I'm hoping to never go through anything like that again. But
yeah, it's like having arthritis.
Yeah, well, there's 11 different diseases that you can get from the tick.
Yeah, I know.
And it's really hard for them to decide which is which. But, that's what I was saying. You know, I felt like doused myself with the gasoline and lighting it to take away some of the pain, but it was really bad.
Yeah, and the next time we have a little accident cutting our finger, just go ahead and tell Sweet, I'm here, come and sew me. And just always remember, think about this in your head. We have the technology. We can rebuild them. Oh.
Well, the Swede wanted to sew my finger up to pay me back for my dental work on him. I thought I did a good job. It didn't hurt me a bit to pull it out, pull his teeth out, but I think it may have hurt him a little bit more than he was willing to admit.
Well, if I ever come up that way, you can pull mine.
I'm here for you. That's what I've been saying. I've been looking forever for somebody to let me try an appendectomy.
Hey, guys, I want to change the subject.
All right.
I sent Bill the area that I go to. Now, this is in New York State. There is not a rock in that place. It's a 5,000-acre preserve. And if you've ever been to New York State, every place you go, there's rock. Any piece of ground is rock. In this preserve, you will not find a rock. No place. In New York State. That's how unusual the topography is of this 5,000-acre preserve is. It was a huge, it was called Lake Rensselaer at one time. Probably 10,000, 15,000 years ago. And there's probably 300 and 400 foot high sand dunes in this place.
Wow.
It's all sand.
Here in Arkansas, all Arkansas is a great big rock with some dirt thrown on it.
That's how New York is. I mean, you can't dig here without hitting rocks. Any place. And you guys have seen movies with these stone walls that these people build on their property.
Yeah.
Where they got the flat rock. That's how it is in New York State. And probably most of New England. You guys are a lot flatter than... No, Arkansas is hilly, right? Mountains?
My part of it is. I live up in the Ozark Mountains.
Uh-huh. Is that... That's not part of the Appalachians, right?
No, it's the Ozarks. It's
Arkansas.
It's
that's
Arkansas.
Up in that Arkansas area, Richard, is where my family's from.
Uh huh. Now, the tree, is it pine trees or maple trees or what?
I think a little bit of everything.
A little bit of everything. There's a lot more hardwood than natural growing pines and all that, but
like manzanita and stuff.
Yeah, we have a lot of, we have a large mixture of hardwood and the softer woods.
Now, why I'm saying this, the kind of these creatures, you think there's a topography they like more than others? I mean, probably not open areas.
There's very few open areas that are natural around here.
Arkansas is mostly thick.
Yeah, well, we got lots of thick underbrush. We got lots of forest land. There where me and the Swede go, it's 280,000 acres, and there may be a field or two out there, but it's not natural. There's places where people have cleared, but no, it's just all rocky hilly forest land.
These things.
Well, everybody, I tell you what, we're getting down towards the Thanksgiving time here. I just wanted to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving.
Everybody. Same day you ever. Happy Thanksgiving, Steve.
You
Rocky,
too there,
Steve.
Richard.
Dave, Steve.
Dave, everybody.
Richard.
Happy Thanksgiving.
You too, Dave.
Rocky and Swede.
God
you
bless you and your families.
We'll see everybody next week. Keep the Bigfoot alive and keep Bigfooting. We'll see everybody next week. Take care now and good night.
Good night. Good night,
good night Marco. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
To y'all.
Well, folks, once again, it's time to say so long. We'd like to thank Mr. Tom Biscardi and his guests and the Bigfoot team for joining us, and we'd especially like to thank you, our listeners, for tuning in. This is Marco Bill saying see you next Wednesday evening for some more Bigfoot Live radio show entertainment with Mr. Tom Biscardi and his team. And until then, keep the Bigfoot live and keep Bigfooting. See you next week.
Three men with a gold and a pact that they'd hold and a promise till the day that they died. Answers to the questions no one's found before. Driving determination, the only key they had to unlock the door. Monsters, myths, and mysteries, legend, tales, and facts. We're all together, reason.